Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's stream. And of course, it is the final Sunday of the month, so it is Book Club. And tonight we are reviewing Hammer of the Patriot, which is published by Claymore Books. Now, we are live tonight on Odyssey, which is our preferred platform. It allows you to stream, upload videos, take donations. It allows you to trade crypto. It allows you to support your favorite content creators. It's basically like YouTube without the censorship, so please support us there. We're also live on DLive. And we are live on RadioAlbion.com, which is the home of Sven Longshanks, who is a wonderful nationalist and works tirelessly for this cause. It's a place where numerous different streams, numerous different radio shows are all collected. So basically, if you go there, you will find a wealth of nationalist material that you can sink your teeth into. Now, tonight's stream lasts about 2 hours. We review the book and then we take questions and answers from the audience. So if you would like to contribute to this stream, or if you'd like to contribute to my work, you can contribute via going to Entropy. The Entropy link will be spammed in the chat throughout the night. Entropy allows you to ask questions. If you ask a question which is unpaid, we'll answer them at the end. But if you ask a paid question or send a donation, which is called a super chat, we will read any question or comment that is attached to a donation. Odyssey, as I said earlier, is a wonderful platform. There is a support button on Odyssey. If you hover over that and click support, you can send a donation. And all of those donations, again, if they have a question or comment attached, we read them out live on stream. Now, if you don't like donating that way and you want to be more anonymous, you can donate via crypto. All my crypto links are in the description beneath this video, whether you're watching it on Odyssey or on BitChute for the replay. Secondly, if you want to find those crypto links, you can find them on my Telegram and Gab. Now, obviously, crypto is like magic beans, and at the moment, the beans are worthless. But one day, they might turn into a big beanstalk, which may or may not have an ogre living at the top of it. But if you want me to look after your magic beans, I am happy to do so. So you can send crypto. Finally, if you want to get in touch with me or send bank transfer, or if you want to give feedback on this stream or any other thing, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. And I nearly always reply unless you send me a circular. So don't subscribe me to your newsletter if I haven't asked to be subscribed, because that will be deleted. But if it's a genuine message, a cry for help or a question or some feedback, I will always reply. So you can write to me there. Now, I'm really looking forward to this particular book club. And the reason being is this book has been published by Claymore Books. And tonight we've got Kenny Smith with us. And I'm going to start by introducing him, because Claymore Books is a nationalist book publisher based here in the United Kingdom. They're going to be publishing a number of other books that relate to ideology and the struggle here in the UK. So this is really important because, again, it's another nationalist business. It's another business that you can help build. It's another business that is providing a service to nationalists. But in this case, it's not something you'd maybe use in your everyday life. It's actually a nationalist service for nationalists by nationalists. So very, very important. And it is important that if you're buying these books, you buy them from a nationalist source. Obviously, if the only place you can get them is Amazon or Lulu, fair enough. But if you can buy them directly from the publisher, that's a lot better for publishers. So, Kenny, obviously, we know you from your work with PA and from your lifetime involvement in the nationalist cause. You're now running Claymore Books. Would you like to tell us a little bit about Claymore Books and introduce yourself?
Hi, Mark. Thank you very much. Yeah, I have been wondering to myself recently if I'm absolutely barking mad, because I have a day job. I've got a post in PA that takes up a lot of time. I've also got a family, and I struggle to fit all these things in quite often, but I decided to start a business as well. So yeah, I'm not quite sure it was the wisest move in the world, but it is something I've wanted the movement to have for a very long time. You and I were involved in the BNP when it was at its height. It was massive, and a lot of money came through the movement, and it fell apart, and there's nothing left to show. Not a printer, not a business, nothing. And what we're doing in PA is very, very different. We're encouraging the nationalist movement to act like a proper community, to build businesses, to work with each other and support each other. And for me, one of the biggest aspects of that is education. I think we failed previously when we were part of the BNP in that we got lots of people involved to get involved with the politics, but we didn't get the families involved like you do in a normal community, and we didn't educate them to stay in the struggle. So I have been working with quite a lot of people behind the scenes, and we've got a fabulous team at Claymore, and we decided just to go for it and start getting back into print books that are hard to get, as you're aware. Amazon and Lulu and places like that have shut down access to nationalist publishers. So we just did, you know, really what Laura did with Grandma Towers, and decided, right, we'll just do it ourselves. And so far, it's working well. I am seem to be pushed for time a lot, but we've got a fabulous team, some folk in England, some folk in Wales, and a couple of guys in Scotland. And we're all, you know, doing it for the good of the movement. And I'm really excited that you guys have chosen to review our first book tonight.
Well, it's a real pleasure having you here, Kenny. And as I said, it's always even better when we are pushing something that is a product, as I said, by nationalists, for nationalists. It's a business that primarily is geared to our needs, run by our people, for our people. So absolute pleasure to have you here tonight. Now, let's go around the group. Obviously, it has been the weekend. Different people would have been doing different things. And we're going to start with Laura, because she is next to Kenny on the screen. Laura, how are you doing? Have you had a good weekend? And did you enjoy the book? And what was your first impression of it?
Hi, everyone. Yes, I had a good weekend. Thank you. And I did enjoy the book. I actually bought this when it went live, when Claymore Books went live, and this book was out to support Kenny and his publishing company. And I sped through it. It's quite a short book. It's how many pages? Let me see. 150 pages, so you can read it really fast. But it's one of those that you just pick up when you want a response to something. So this book, for anyone who's not read it, it teaches you how to argue from a nationalist perspective. But rather than filling your head with a load of statistics and a load of sort of like logical rebuttals, it teaches you how to use force. And it's more of a battle for dominance rather than a battle for facts. Obviously we have facts on our side as well. But so, for example, do you remember when Tommy Robinson went on TV with Piers Morgan, and Piers Morgan were calling him all these names, and Tommy Robinson were like, oh, no, I'm not, no, I'm not, no, I'm not. And he was defending himself. The audience are watching that and thinking to themselves, well, Piers is in power there. So what this book does is it teaches you to be in power and put the other person on the back foot. So it doesn't have things like, well, actually, that's wrong because these are the correct statistics. They're not the kind of arguments it has. It has stuff where you put your opponent in their place and mock them and humiliate them. And you can actually be quite brutal with them as well. And it's like a battle for dominance and power. And the idea is that if somebody's watching, they'll see you as a winner and want to side with you. So it's a really good book. You can just pick it up. And if you need an answer to a certain question, there are some in there. I like a lot of them. There are some of them that I wouldn't use. I think I'd say something else. But I do think there is something for everyone in there. The only criticism I will have, and it's not actually a criticism, it's just by chance, but it is from an American perspective. So some of the responses are not, they don't really count for us. So, for example, when someone says, you invaded someone else's land and there were immigrants or there weren't natives there already. Obviously, as an American, you'd have a different response to a British person. So that's the only criticism that I have, really. But 90-95% of the answers in there are relevant. So, yeah, it's really good. And pass back to you, Mark.
Well, our next guest on the panel tonight is the lovely Aunt Sally. But wait a second. Aunt Sally used to be the queen of technical issues, but she now has a world-class professional microphone and headset setup. So I'm hoping tonight we're going to have the first night of absolutely perfect audio from Aunt Sally. And take it away, Aunt Sally. Did you enjoy the book? Did you have a good weekend? And what are your initial impressions?
Oh, hello, everybody. I did have a good weekend, yes. It's weird now. I've got this microphone. I hope the sound's coming through really well.
Sally, that sounds really, really good. It's really clear.
Oh, good. It's like I still want to lean all over it like I used to before with the computer, you know, when I was using the audio, the mic on the computer. I used to lean on it and, you know, it was terrible. But, yeah, thank you for this, Mark. I've gotten the other question. Did I enjoy the book? Yeah, I really did. I really did. I'm too old. I'm not into debating. But there's some really good sound bites in there. For when you do come up against somebody, like I've had family members argue with me, and there's some really good sound bites. So, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay, absolutely wonderful audio there, as clear as a blackbird song. And finally, last but certainly not least, is Natty. Did you have a good weekend, my friend? What have you been up to? Did you enjoy the book, and what were your initial impressions?
Hi, guys. Yes, I've had a fantastic weekend. Been at a rowing competition in Plymouth on Saturday, followed by Tunes.
Did you win?
Oh, sorry. What was that,
Mark? Did you win?
We didn't, no. We got knocked out in the semi-finals, unfortunately.
Oh, gutted, mate. Gutted.
It's very
I wouldn't have put my money on you anyway, mate. I wouldn't have put my money on you anyway.
Well, I wasn't rowing. I was coxing. So, you know, that's probably why we didn't win. You know, if I'd been in the boat, you know, big arms, big shoulders, we would have won.
But yeah, mate, you are impressively built. So why were you just hiding in there giving orders? Like,
unfortunately, the way the crews had to be stacked, it was a mixed championship. So it was girls and boys in the boat, and we didn't have any more experienced coxes. So I had to take the reins, unfortunately. But still, it was good fun. It was good fun, and it was a good weekend. And I went to a festival last night, a local festival down here in Cornwall called Tunes in the Dunes, which was good fun. I didn't drink too much, had a good night, and gave some friends a lift home. So very, very non-degenerate, very non-degenerate weekend, thankfully. As to the book, this is fantastic. We've covered a lot of books on the book review, and most of them have approached things from our perspective in different ways. And I remember the Transgender Industrial Complex. I'm sure you can all remember that book. That was a slog to get through, although it was packed with information and various parts of a puzzle. I'm looking up at my shelf now. We had Edward Dutton's Making Sense of Race. These are really educational books. They really help put things into place in your mind. Hammer of the Patriot is almost like being back in secondary school. You know, it's like a textbook. And for anyone who's ever going to run into debates, or it even thinks about getting into debates with lefties or disingenuous people you find on the internet, even in the media or politicians, I know that, just as an aside, some of the responses that Mark, yourself and Laura have put together, and some of the regional guys have done to media attacks on PA, have included responses that just leave absolutely no room, no equivocating. They're not rolling over, like Laura said, Tommy Robinson style, and saying, no, we're not racist. No, we're not this. No, stop. You know, full on dominate the response. Leave no room for them to kind of pick things out and make you look weak. And this book is brilliant at giving you the tools in your mind to do that. So I can't recommend it enough. And if I'd had this book before I'd started making gripe calls, I'm sure they would have been, you know, at least some order of magnitude more effective and more engaging to listen to. So unfortunately, you know, this book comes to me slightly too late. But I was happy to buy it as soon as Claymore Books got off the ground. So mine's not a review copy either. I purchased this one, and I'm happy to do so. And I recommend, before we finish, I recommend that everyone else does the same thing.
Okay, well, as you know, I'm not really a reader. I'm not somebody who enjoys reading. I'm not somebody who can sit down for hours going through a book. And as you know, in the past, I have been quite critical of some of the longer books and quite enjoyed some of the shorter books. And I'm a fan of what is known as a toilet book. And a toilet book is not a book that should be flushed down the toilet, but is a book that you can, in fact, read on the toilet. Now, that means you can pick it up, you can leaf through it, and you can pull out bits of information that you need, or read a couple of pages at a time, put it back down, and then pick it up a little bit later without losing your place in the book or forgetting where you are. I remember I once read a Stephen King novel called Needless Things. Sorry, Needless Things. It was a needless thing because I didn't finish it. It was called Needful Things. And I did enjoy it, but the chapters were so long that it just took so much effort to read them. And if you tried to read a chapter in multiple parts and sleep on it, you'd kind of have to jump back a few pages to remember what you read. And this is the very opposite of that. This is like a handbook that you can pull little bits of information out of. And if you wanted, you could read it in one session, or you could read it in 100 little sessions, as I said, like a toilet book, and you wouldn't lose anything either way. And that gets my thumbs up. That initially makes me very happy. So if you haven't got a lot of time, you can buy it. It's quite a short book as well, which is good. It's not a book which is padded out with rubbish. It is all killer, no filler. This isn't a book that's just padded out with extra bits that you don't need. And it's one of the few books we've reviewed on Book Club that actually covers something that people always ask me. Now, when I started doing my long form shows, and by long form, I mean the shows like This Week on the Alt-Right, which then morphed into which morphed into PWR. And I remember doing those shows, and I always get asked, still to this day, get asked, Mark, how do you present an argument? How is it best to talk to our people? How can we introduce our ideas to normies in the best way possible? And that's something that's very important. And I think this book answers that question. This book helps anybody who is sat round a dinner table. Now, I would say this is primarily sort of about debates between liberals and nationalists. And that's what it says on the back. It says debates between liberals and nationalists are not about logic or finding the truth. They're struggles for dominance. But how many people do you know, or you might even be one of these people, who sat at a dinner table with friends or relatives, and somebody at the table will pick an ideological fight with you? Somebody at the table will, I'm not going to say kick off, but start throwing insults at you, or jibes, or trying to rip you apart in front of the other guests. Now, this is the book you need to read to answer that person. This is the book that gives you an answer to everything. And it doesn't give a dry answer. And by a dry answer, I mean it doesn't answer everything with oodles of statistics. Now, statistics are good because they back up your point, but they're very difficult to remember. You know, think back to being at school. If you went into an exam and you had to remember sort of a list of percentages or statistics or pure facts, that's very difficult to do. But remembering a theory, then applying that theory to an example that's posed to you in an exam paper is much, much easier. And I felt that this book totally strays away from, well, 13% commit 56% kind of thing. And instead, goes towards arguments that I would use, short analogies, little quips, things that you could say to people that would make everyone at the table laugh, that would make everyone at the table see your point of view. And without being rude, you would actually manage to demean the person you're arguing with. And that's very important, because nationalists have spent years being very, very polite and being on the defensive. When I debate people, I'm not particularly polite, and I'm not ever on the defensive. I'm always on the offensive. I'm always looking to silence them, to talk over them, to push our points, because that's how you win those debates. And as somebody so rightly said tonight, when Tommy Robinson ended up with Piers Morgan, he allowed Piers Morgan to bully him. And I wouldn't have done that. I would have come back with something cutting. I'd have come back on the attack. And I've got to say this because it's topical at the moment and not everyone will like the guy. But at the moment in the news, there's a guy called Mick Lynch. I don't know how many of you are sort of familiar with this guy. He is the head of or the leader of the RMT union. He's doing the rounds at the moment, justifying the rail strikes because they're causing, you know, a lot of pain for normal people. But he believes in his cause. Now, I'm not saying whether his cause is right or wrong, but he is a master at debating. He's a master at humiliating people. And he completely humiliated Piers Morgan the other day on Piers Morgan's new show, to the point where Piers Morgan is basically blocking anyone on Twitter who's mentioning it, because just everyone's laughing at him and roasting him. And that's the kind of thing that nationalists need to do. And I'm going to say this, and this will probably please Kenny more than anyone, it might please a few other people listening. But if Nick Griffin had read this book or had this book before his disastrous Question Time performance, we could be living in a very different timeline now. Because when nationalists go out to debate, they have to be able to quip. They have to be on point. They have to be able to present their ideas in a very, very emotional way that pulls on people's heartstrings, gets people laughing at the person they're debating with, and fundamentally connects on a level deeper than just dry facts and figures. And as such, I've got to say, and I usually leave my recommendations to the end, I'd recommend this to anybody who has asked the question on PWR or Tutar before it, Mark, how do I sell our ideas to the public? How do I sell nationalism to people around the family dinner table? Well, this is how you sell it. It's a phenomenal handbook. And if you want to get on the debate scene, if you want to be a public face of a nationalist movement, if this isn't in your library, you're doing yourself a disservice. Now, let's go around the group and we'll discuss the book in a little bit more detail. Kenny, obviously, you are not Charles Chappell or Chappell or however he pronounces it. Do you actually know the author?
No, I don't. He's a French Canadian who is in a bit of bother with the authorities over there at the moment, and has not basically responded to any attempts at communication. So I have got a section in the foreword where we're basically saying, you know, get in touch. We love your work. We've republished it because it's impossible to get. We'll sort you out if you're wanting, you know, royalties from it. We're putting it back into service because it is such a great book. Charlie Big Potatoes was the first man to tell me about it and said that, you know, he's one of these newer guys in the movement who is fantastic at debates as well. You know, he's taken on Muslims and lefties and all sorts and always done fantastically well. And he does it with a smile on his face. He doesn't lose his cool. And some of his put downs are fantastic. And you know, I was talking to him about it and he recommended this book and we could only get, you know, PDFs on the internet. So I tried for months reaching out to this fella. We knew who he was and just had no response. But I think it may be to do with his legal bother. So maybe when that's resolved, he'll get in touch. For me, this book does all of these things. Debates, as Mean Pemus has said to me, one of the chaps from PA Talk, are where we refine points among friends. This book teaches us that the enemy is there to be crushed. And that's what we have to do. Their arguments are repetitive. They are the same all the time. They look, you know, for victimhood status. They rely on emotions and feelings and quite often mask their true agenda. And that usually gets unmasked when they're dealing with us because they become extremely hostile. And we can use that to our advantage. And this book is brilliant for teaching that. And one point I'd like to pick up what Laura said earlier. Yes, this book does come from a North American perspective. I think the author's French Canadian. And when they talk about things like, oh, you Americans, you stole the Indians' land. We still use that same argument and that same idea, the rebuttals that are in this book. Because from a UK perspective, we get told about colonialism. We get told about, oh, you went to India and you stole the land and you stole these resources and you treated people abysmally. It's all nonsense. But this book is more about teaching the methods of how to deal with these people, and that really they're quite repetitive in their arguments. There is a pattern to it. And we just have to tailor a response to deal with that. So there's a lot of things in the book that do come from a North American perspective. You know, they've got, you know, a different, you know, constitution from us. And the right wing is very religious as well. And you see elements of that in the book. But it's the way we deal with these things and with the way we respond with these things on the front foot. And, you know, quite often what I love is just, it's the combativeness of it. It's being aggressive and standing up, just, you know, as you were saying. And yeah, to go back to touch on that question time, you know, that was one of the lowest points in the movement for me. And something if he had brought this approach, would have been absolutely fantastic, because nationalism should be the promote dominance, should promote confidence, because, you know, what we're seeing is standing up for our people. You know, we shouldn't be cowed and apologizing for anything. And this book is brilliant.
So I'm going to go around the group now and say, what was your favorite, like, going through this? Obviously, some of the talking points you might know, some of you you wouldn't. What was your favorite talking point in this book? And we'll start with you, Laura.
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure if I have a favorite one. I'll just read out some of the headings so that the audience can get an idea of what's covered. So there's politics, so nationalism, democracy, freedom, capitalism and libertarianism, use of violence and helping the third world. And then we've also got things like feminism, religion, homosexuality. And then there's a chapter called Other Perversions. And then there's a race chapter. So racial differences, diversity, Jews, white genocide, white pride. And then there's a miscellaneous chapter at the back. So it covers everything, really. And they're all topics that we talk about. So I think it was a good few months ago now that I read it. So I can't remember which arguments come from this book and which ones were from other places. But any topic that you will get into a debate regarding as a nationalist, it's covered in this book. So, yeah, that's how I'll answer. I'll pass it back.
Okay, Natty, over to you. Just unmute.
Yeah, I was going to let Sally go first, but I don't really have a favourite rebuttal to a single argument, but one of the best chapters one of the best sections in here is the rebuttal to human rights. And it's very topical at the moment, because in this country we've got the whole channel crossing, illegal migrants in dinghies, pony show with the ensuing flights to Rwanda, but again it's just theater. And some of the underpinning political arguments are focused around the human rights issue. And then in America, which I know this book is kind of more geared towards, although it only shows in a very few areas, the whole Roe versus Wade retracting in the Supreme Court. Human rights, again, just before I go into this, the rebuttals to these arguments, the arguments are maybe one sentence long, okay? So for instance, if I just turn to a random page here, argument, you're being racist, that's it. And then the rebuttal is maybe two sentences. So there's a few rebuttals here that you could just use. Number one, everyone's racist. We all understand that there are different kinds of people and that we treat them differently. It's just that some people are comfortable with that and accept it as part of life, and others feel guilty and are in denial. That's it. That's an argument against you and a rebuttal you can use. And there's a couple more rebuttals in here. The point is, for a lot of these, for most of these subjects, it's covered in such a way that you don't have to know. It's the replies are instinctual. And with human rights, the whole human rights section of a book, it leans into the fact that it's just who holds power. Human rights is just this invention by, Europeans to ensure that we try and treat each other nicely and decently. And when you try and map it onto Africans or South Americans or people who have no concept of what our idea of human rights is, it just becomes a power struggle, a power game of those in power, what you can impose on those who aren't in power. And to point that out to people, especially now, and for most of the topics and most of the kind of 24-hour news cycle focuses around something that will involve the base argument about what we can do to each other and what we can't do to each other due to human rights. It's really good on just being able to take that stuff apart and rip into people who use it as a shield against policies that hurt white people and hurt Europeans.
Okay, Sally, did you have any particular favourite parts of the book? Was there anything in the book that you thought was really sort of eye-opening for you in the way it was presented?
Yes, definitely. I've got so many notes because the others have read the book before, but I've read it this last week, and I've got so many notes on it. But I think the chapter on society was my favourite. I've actually written that down. And there's so many notes just from that, but the feminist put downs I thought were really good. There's one here: women are oppressed by men. You must really have contempt for women if you think they're these fragile, spineless children who must be protected from men by government regulations. And you really must have a dark view of men if you think they would conspire for thousands of years to keep women in servitude while living with them, raising children with them, and growing old together. I think you're a completely disconnected from reality. You seem to hold everyone in contempt. I like that one. There's so many I've got there.
It's funny, isn't it, Tal? Because loads of these responses, or quite a few of them, have this kind of humorous edge to them as well. And if you think about, I mean, because I know that you know these people as well, if you think about the way Charlie Big Potatoes argues, or the Ayatollah, or even Mark and Laura, they've got slightly different styles, but you can see, you know, you can see where the strengths are, and Charlie's ability to laugh off quite pointed or attacking questions, or the Ayatollah's aggressiveness, you know, when he goes in on someone who's just being like rabidly anti-white. So it's having that like aggressive response that, you know, makes someone feel really stupid when you read that in the responses is like humorous as well as like enjoyable to listen to.
Yeah, I mean, there was another one as well I really liked. I'm just looking. Oh, I can't find it.
Well, I'll just add while you're looking for it. I know, Mark, you said about the dining room table and maybe someone attacking you, you know, for your nationalist beliefs while you're sitting around the table. But most of us will have been, and like you said, most of us would have been in that situation. But even when you're like a school kid, you can probably remember a time when there was a group of you standing around and maybe you're getting roasted for something, or maybe you're the one doing the roasting and, you know, you feel so small and you're getting, you know, like laughed at or whatever it is. And it doesn't have to be, I'm not saying it's like a bullying thing, but, you know, you're being dominated for verbally for whatever reason. The ability to kind of change it around and then bring the audience back onto your side. This is what that book is about. Because it's not so much about educating whoever you're arguing with. The book recognizes that it's going to be someone who's arguing with you in bad faith and is attempting to make you look bad, make you look like an evil person and to attach all these labels to you. And the idea is to just bring whoever's listening onto your side and make them look stupid, make them look foolish, make them look evil. And everything that they're trying to do to you is just put it right back onto them. Like you said, without the use of statistics or graphs or studies, you know, the famous Vouch and Destiny claims. Have you got a study to back that up? Have you got a study to back that up? Well, it just bypasses all of that. So it's an enjoyable thing to read. Like I said, it's a textbook. To have this on hand if you were going to go into a Telegram debate, even if you were just to go into one as practice, look at some of the arguments in there in, say, one of the Tommy Robinson chats or maybe the Reverend Simon Sideways' chat, and then just go through and formulate and look through this book and have a look the kind of things you would respond to.
I found that one that I was just saying, it's good and bad depends on culture. You're just Eurocentrist. The rebuttal is, I judge things according to European values, European ethics and European culture. You can call that Eurocentrist if you want. What values are you using to judge the world? Chinese Taoism, the tribal laws of the Bantu? We better settle this before moving on. And then there's a reply, I'm a humanist, I don't reply on Eurocentric views. That would be their reply. And yours is, I like this, humanism is the most European ideology there is. Good luck finding humanists in the jungles of the Congo or mountains of Peru. I like that one. Yeah, I've got so many notes on it. And you're going to have to memorise these things. I'm going to read this book over and over again and probably highlight the most common things. You know, the common one, which is there's good and bad in all races and all that sort of thing. Just work my way through the book and save the best responses and adapt them to my own.
I think that's the nail on the head, Sally. The key is not just to memorize word for word what's in these rebuttals. It's to tailor them to your own needs and own circumstances, depending on who you're debating with. My personal favourite from the whole book is quite early on, where it says that the argument is the whole world is becoming multi-ethnic. It's the future. Get used to it. And the rebuttal is the world is not becoming multi-ethnic. White countries are becoming multi-ethnic, and nowhere but white countries. And the average white person is intelligent enough to know that they are being displaced by these immigrants. Only degenerate weaklings would embrace that and get used to it. I absolutely love that. And I used that dozens of times on Twitter before I finally got banned. And pretty much every time they responded to, I mean, I was putting in things like a limp-wristed degenerate weakling and things like that. And that ended up as what they would focus on. So they would change the attempt to change the debate away from the fact that it's only white, operating white countries, and pick on that. I would call them weak. And I said, never mind how weak you are. You tell me that this is happening in black countries or Asian countries. And the book is full of wee devastating things like that. But it's tailoring them to your own needs, and depending on who you're debating with, that's the key. Learn the rules, learn the pattern, and then do what suits you.
Can I just expand just very quickly, just cap off what you were saying there, Kenny?
No, you and Aunt Sally, go for it. You sound like you've both got loads of notes. I mean, I'm finding it fascinating hearing what you said, because obviously I spend a lot of time doing these big debates and things like that, and Laura does as well. So hearing from people who don't engage in that kind of thing and what you found of the books is fascinating. So both of you, please carry on.
Yeah, I just wanted to just mark what Kenny said there. This is from the conclusion, and the conclusion's only a page and a half. It says, make note, and this is something that we should all remember. I mean, you can have this book or not have this book, but this is something that you should be instilled into anyone who's even interested in this subject. Like Kenny was saying, make no mistake, the overwhelming majority of whites are concerned about the waves of hostile immigrants flooding into their country. They're also horrified at the degeneracy being promoted on television and in movies. They are silent because they believe they are alone and isolated. That is where we come in. And then it goes on from there. But, you know, that's just to kind of say what you're saying there, Kenny, is true. You know, we're not alone, but people feel isolated. So to be able to say this stuff and say it proudly, clearly, with purpose, whilst at the same time making our enemies look stupid, is no small thing.
There's another one there as well that I really liked. This is a really common one. Diversity is our strength. And the rebuttal is, which group is stronger? A group of strangers speaking different languages or a close-knit family? You can't argue. Who can argue with that?
I love that. That's even smaller. That's an even shorter response than the normal one that
That's my note. So that's probably me abbreviated it.
No. The usual response to that is about the football team. And, you know, if you've got a football team where everyone's doing their own thing versus a football team where they're all working together, who's gonna win? But the response in here is even shorter and more succinct, more appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, I reading the book, I found myself wondering, if you'd written the book, Mark, and if you'd written the, you and Laura had written the book, because it's a definite masculine style of debating in the book. And I, you know, when Laura debates, and I watch all your debates, you are, Laura is the what's it you call her, a hammer in a sock, sledgehammer in a sock, and because she comes out with
sledgehammer in a silk glove. It's a snooker ball in a sock, Aunt Sally. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
You're going to get a prison beating with a snooker ball in a sock.
What was I thinking? I think I watched the film Scum a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, what was I forgot what I was going to say now. No, but when Laura debates, you come out with, you have these facts and figures in your head to throw at them. It's a more feminine way, I think, of doing it, is having the facts and figures, because no one can argue with them. Whereas, Mark, you are quite aggressive when you debate. But I like the gentle path, the gentle way that Laura does it. But I'd love to see that sort of book written by you two. And that's what I kept wondering, like, what would Laura say and what would Mark say to this or to that? You know, yeah.
Well, there's one thing I really liked in the book. There's what my favourite was, this. It says, argument. If something is done between two consenting adults is none of society's business. Rebuttal. If two consenting adults make a campfire in the privacy of their own bedroom, it'll definitely be society's business when the house burns down and damages the surrounding buildings. People these days have no sense of responsibility. Acts have consequences. Reply. What consequences do they have if two people do S&M stuff? Rebuttal. People with mental problems need to seek help. If they don't, they will be a bad influence on society. Now, I found that really humorous. And I think the campfire analogy is pretty funny. And I think that's the kind of thing that I like, because when you get people laughing, it's hard to dislike somebody who makes you laugh. And I remember watching a debate. I actually forget what the guy's name was. And I feel really bad saying that now, because he's a really, really hilarious guy. He used to help nationalists with their IT work. And he's got a funny name, which is sort of an abbreviation of a name. He's a well-known hacker and sort of internet trouble causer. I forget his name. It'll come back to me. He had a really interesting YouTube channel at one point, which has now been taken down. And I remember seeing him in this debate on whether you should wrap your children in cotton wool. And he was coming out with stuff, and it was just so funny. Everyone was laughing. And the people that were trying to belittle him then couldn't, because the audience was just thought he was so funny that from that point, they couldn't help but like him. And I think that has a real level of effectiveness, and laughter is sometimes that's underestimated. And this did give me a few chuckles during reading it. And that, I think, is I think that is something that is really, really important.
Mark, did you read this before you and I debated those two young American lads?
Oh, no. That night.
Because you were brutal that night.
I was brutal. And I've got to say, they were two absolute dibs. And the things they were saying, what they were trying to do was bring an argument down to a level where it can't be won. So we would say something like, look, when it comes down to it, if you grow your population endlessly, there is going to be a greater fight for resources. There's going to be a greater level of scarcity. And as you increase scarcity, prices always rise. And obviously, we've seen that in the UK. We've seen a huge rise in house prices as the population booms. I mean, last year alone, Boris Johnson let in 1 million people. Well, if you're letting in 1 million people, the argument is some of them will leave. Well, they might do. But while they're living here, they're all going to need a place to live. Well, if every year 1 million extra people are needing places to live in the UK, that is going to cause a massive scarcity of rental properties, of land, of houses on the housing market, and all of that will drive prices up. Now, that's a common sense argument. So when somebody comes back at you with, oh, do you have a learned report from an anti-white university to back up that idea? The answer is not to get bogged down in that. That's just to then insult the person, belittle them, and call them out for being an idiot. Because if you actually go down their road and start looking for a learned report from Finkelstein and Schekelberg that backs up a common sense argument, pro tip, there isn't going to be one. And they will keep saying things like, hey, we've got a peer-reviewed paper that backs our ideas up. Well, yeah. Dr. Schekelberg has come up with this crazy idea that the more people living in an area, actually, that reduces house prices because reasons. And then he passes it to Mr. Finkelstein, who peer reviews it and says, you know what, Schekelberg, I've never heard such a brilliant theory. House prices are pushed down the more people come into an area. Well, that's your peer-reviewed paper. It's written by somebody and reviewed by somebody who have an atavistic hatred for people of European descent. And once you're in that playpen, once you're in that ring of arguing based on who can find the most peer-reviewed papers from anti-white institutions that back up anti-white ideas, well, no nationalist winning that argument. It's impossible to win that argument because the argument is stacked against you because there's nobody at university who agrees with us. Well, there might be a couple of people, but they're certainly not writing papers. And if they did, they'd never achieve peer review status because they'd be putting forward talking points that the people who run the universities don't want to talk about. And that's why I made the point during that debate. And a lot of people, oh, Mark, you weren't professional. You didn't have all your peer-reviewed papers there. Well, that's because there isn't any. And I did say during that, you know, these are the kind of things where if I say grass is green, there will be somebody at this university who says, no, it's blue. And they'll find somebody to back it up. They'll say, yeah, it's blue. And I'll sit there saying, well, I can see it's green. Everyone can see it's green. This is observable to anyone. It's a common sense point, but the peer review papers say the opposite. And that's why this book's important, because it doesn't get bogged down in that navel gazing where you're actually looking for something that you'll never find, because no nationalist will ever find one of these peer review papers that backs up their point, because the people writing them hate us. And they're not real science, they're not real academia. Because academia and science has now been completely captured by people who are pushing an agenda. So when the science or the academia doesn't back up their feelings and their political viewpoint, it just gets absolutely discarded. That's why you've got entire sections of science, such as race and IQ, the link between IQ and civilizational development, that have just been developed over, you know, decades or centuries, but have just been completely thrown aside within a short number of years because they don't fit the current political views of those running institutions. So that's, again, that's why I find this book so interesting. And also, I do kind of like being brutal to people when I debate them. And the reason I like being brutal and just humiliating them and getting the audience laughing is because when you look at Piers Morgan and people like that, usually they do win their debates. And how do they win them? Well, they don't always win them by putting over the best talking points. They win them by getting their opponents on the back foot. And unfortunately, I've seen numerous nationalist leaders get to the highest pinnacle of TV representation, whether that be GMTV in the morning or Question Time in the evening, and completely crack because instead of coming out swinging, they go on the defensive. Now, ultimately, you're never, ever going to win a fight by putting up your hands and hoping to block every blow coming in or dodge every blow coming in. The only way you win a fight is by landing blows yourself. And every nationalist that has been schooled in debate, and they've been schooled by somebody who's told them, you will win by being the nice guy and going out there and being meek and mild and playing the victim and being kicked around for 45 minutes. Well, that's not the right kind of schooling. That's bad advice. And this book gives the opposite. It gives good advice. And I think it certainly got me laughing. And Sully, you said you've got loads of notes. So I do want to hear these notes, because in the past, sometimes you haven't been able to say all the things you've wanted to say due to technical issues. But tonight, we have no technical issues.
Oh, I'm just looking at the moment. Hang on.
While Sally's hunting, can I just say, Mark, you're absolutely spot on there. I've heard for years the truth will prevail mantra, and it's utter tripe. It doesn't. You have to win and dominate the argument.
Well, I remember seeing Nick Griffin on Question Time, and they kept asking him about the Holocaust, and he kept coming out and saying, oh, I can't say. If I say something about the Holocaust, I could be extradited to Germany. And he thought that was a good argument. So he had Jack Straw on the panel, who was the Home Secretary. And Jack Straw said, I promise you, I give you my word as Home Secretary, that you can say whatever you want for the next 45 minutes and I will make sure you are not prosecuted. Tell us what you really think. Now, that was a dangerous thing for Jack Straw to say, because Jack Straw was saying, do as you please. But at that point, Griffin was exposed, because he wasn't saying, I'll be extradited to Germany. Because he really thought he'd be extradited to Germany. He was saying that because he didn't want to answer the question. And Jack Straw gambled on the fact that Griffin didn't want to answer the question. And when he gave him his assurance and Griffin still didn't answer the question, everyone burst into laughter. Now, if I'd been a question to him, and Jack Straw had said, you can say whatever you want, well... I would have, I think at that point, I'd have taken my jacket off, rolled up my sleeves, and it had been 45 minutes of pure unadulterated madness that would have been clipped out and replayed on YouTube, Telegram, Gab, wherever, for eternity, because I'd have gone to town. And even if I felt I hadn't been able to go to town, I'd have thrown something to him, such as, well, if you believe in the Holocaust so much, if you believe that 6 million people really were exterminated by the Nazis, why is it illegal to question this? Because if it's so true, why does the truth fear investigation? And why is everything else that's happened throughout history, all the other mass murders, the tens of millions killed by communists in Eastern Europe, the tens of millions of Chinese killed under Chairman Mao, why do the killing fields of Cambodia, why are all of those things up for debate? Why are numbers constantly debated? But the Holocaust is the one thing you can't debate. What makes that so special? And you'd throw it back to them. You would, if you don't want to answer a question, there's always a way to throw it back without directly answering. But obviously, there's so much to say on those things. But Jack Straw got people laughing at him. And once people were laughing at him, there was no comeback. There was no way. There was no way to pull back from that. Because once, and it's just, remember, what happens at school might seem to be something that's a long time away, especially when you're sort of my age, I'm 41. You might think the classroom and being at school is a long time away. But people don't actually change that much from school. When you're at school, you act in a certain way, and you more or less act in an instinctive way. You do things more instinctively. Now, as you get older, you still have those instincts, but you bury them and you become slightly more polite. But in the right circumstances, those instincts do come out. And if you remember it in class, when there was a guy humiliating another kid and everyone was laughing, once everyone was laughing at that kid, there was no way he could make a comeback. Even if everything he was saying was right, even if what was being done to him was unfair, once the whole class was in fits of laughter at someone else, that someone else, the only way they could get out of that was wait till the bell rings and come back the next day and start again, because everyone was giggling at them. And that's what happened on Question Time. Jack Straw gambled on making everyone laugh, but he also knew the psychology of people, that deep down, we all have those instincts that we had as children. It's just we bury them. And if you can bring them back to the surface and you can get everyone acting in that sort of mob mentality as they do at school, well, at that point, whoever's on the beating or so on the receiving end of the beating, they're absolutely done for. That is what you have to do. And that's why when I was debating those young lads, the audience were mainly people of Zoomer age. It was all Nick Fuentes' audience. It was on Nick Fuentes' platform. And at the time, that was the second most watched stream ever. And when it came to the vote at the end, who won the debate, me and Laura won 100% because we got everyone laughing. And once they were laughing, there was no turning back the tide. Laughter is an important thing. Facts and figures are also important to back up your argument, but they're dry and boring. And normal people respond more to laughter and emotion than they do just tides of facts and figures. Now, Sally, have you got your notes? Because I'm eager to hear them.
There are so many. It's like, which one do I pick? There's one here. The argument is, now we're liberated from all those traditions, old traditions, we're free. I don't want to be constrained like we used to be. Our old European traditions and customs that have all gone. And the rebuttal, our ancestors weren't idiots. Those old traditions have been devised over thousands of years and we kept them because they worked. The purpose of these traditions is to promote society in which people are safer and happier. The traditions protected us against our own childish inclinations. We threw it all away to get a little bit of fast living in our youth. And as a result, our civilization is on the brink of destruction, whilst the fast livers will be rotting in old folks' homes with no kids to support them, no spouses to share their old age, and no one but employees paid by the government to take care of them. What a mess. Yeah, I really like that one because I'm in my early 60s and I'm seeing it now of people that didn't have children or they were lousy parents, fathers split up and whatever and went and didn't bring up their children. Now they're old and no one cares about them. They're the ones that are in old folks' home and being abused and God knows what. And it's all because really, if you track it back to our traditions, when I was a child, old people weren't abandoned like they are now. So, I really like that one. Don't know what anyone else thought of that.
That's the kind of argument made by someone who regrets maybe their decisions in life, like you say, and ends up childless, drinking wine, surrounded by cats, for instance, right? Rather, maybe as opposed to like a lefty or a liberal who's making those kind of arguments. But it's certainly true. It's right to point out, 50 years worth of change and the promotion, or even less, 20 years, whatever it is, 5 years, the heavy promotion of transgenderism, sodomy, homosexuality, single parenthood as just being a fine and equally acceptable way to raise children. It's having this terrible effect on society. And to deny it is just denying reality. I mean, who's going to argue that, well, now we can have a washing machine that's connected to the internet. Well, isn't that great? When families are falling apart, politics is this kind of just giant joke where nobody feels like they're represented at all. And you think about the time our parents grew up, like you say, Sal, where you could leave your door unlocked, even if you lived in certain parts of London that are now just complete, multi-ethnic ghettos that you wouldn't want to step foot in daylight, let alone in the middle of the night. That's why we long to go back. And I think that argument and the rebuttal captures the essence of that, where you think maybe the people who lived before us were constrained in certain ways in terms of their behavior in society and the way it affected society, because the lack of the internet meant there'd be, unless you wanted to be a hermit and a recluse, which some people were. I mean, to be sure, I know old people now who lived like that and still live like that, surrounded by stacks of newspapers and train sets and all the rest of it. But you had to interact with people, and that interaction forced a kind of a social cohesion and a kind of a looking over what everyone else is doing. And if they started doing something that was passed down through generations as to be understood as something destructive or would lead to destructive things for society, like Mark said, lighting a campfire in your bedroom, you would frown on that, and maybe there would be some tutting from the ladies, and maybe the guys would say, you know, sort it out, mate, and give him a nudge, or if he really got out of hand, you know, take him around the back of a pub and fill him in or whatever, you know? So there were these corrective measures that have just been completely thrown out in favor of do what you want. I mean, I don't know if you guys are fans of The Simpsons, but there's an episode on The Simpsons where this self-help guru turns up in Springfield, and he's on stage selling his latest book about how to be more happy and more successful. And he brings Bart up on stage, and Bart says, he says, how did you come up with this amazing philosophy on life, Bart? And Bart says, I don't know. I just do what I feel like. And the guy, obviously sensing his opportunity, says, do what you feel like. Man, what a great slogan. Do what you feel like. And he has a whole town doing what they feel like. And in a matter of days, like, there's no police force anymore. The place is complete anarchy and everything's fallen apart. And it seems like that's just a microcosm of what's happening in society, or certainly in the West today, is this kind of do what you feel like attitude.
Do you know what I find really interesting about that? And I've got to throw this out because I think it's very important. When you actually look at where this do what you feel like started, it was actually a guy called Aleister Crowley. And I'm just looking up the quote. He was obviously an occultist, a Satanist. And his law, I think it was something as do what thou will and let that be the whole law. And it was basically do whatever you wish and do it, you know, as much as you want,
without regard for anyone else or anything.
Yeah, and basically, it's quite interesting that this occultist, this man who lived a very debauched and bizarre and fundamentally oddball life, who dabbled in black magic and all kinds of strange things, he's sort of someone who really captured the imagination of a lot of artists, a lot of musicians, a lot of people in Hollywood, a lot of rock stars specifically. And his mantra has kind of fed in to the mindset of Western civilization that we should just do whatever makes us happy. But by doing so, and I wrote about this in my book, you become more animalistic and less human by doing so.
Of course, I mean, it flows. Yeah. If you give in to your baser instincts, that's what animals do. I think there's one in here. I don't know what page it's on, but it's saying, you know, if gays want to kiss in public, that's fine. You know, and animals are homosexuals. Some animals are homosexuals too. And the rebuttal was something like, well, dogs lick their balls in public, but you don't go around licking your balls in public or other people's balls in public. You know, why would you aspire to be like an animal? Why would you use animalistic behavior as your kind of defense? That's one of the things that, like we were talking about, for thousands of years, the strive to be better human beings and create better societies has been founded on moving away from animalistic tendencies or controlling them to the point where they don't become destructive. And that's not a bad thing. It sounds kind of stifling, but in fact, it's liberating to take on responsibility and not give in to your base instinct. It makes you feel human. It makes you feel alive. A struggle against just living in a, you know, a pit and doing nothing. And, you know what people mean when they say degeneracy, not giving in to those kind of things, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say that on top of Aleister Crowley, before him, there was, in the Victorian times, there was... I think her name was Helena Blavatsky, and her protege, which was Alice Bailey. And they were very much into all that Aleister Crowley crap, do what thou wilt. But I think they were before him. Yeah, of course they were Victorian. So they were part of this subversion, definitely. I think from that sort of crowd, the Fabian Society and all that lot. And they probably targeted the famous people of their day that we were on the last book club you know, the rock stars of their time, the Victorian time, the I forget their names, the people that we did the last book club. You know, you put his picture up, Natty. What was his name? Why?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. When we're talking about the Mad Art.
Those people, the poets and the painters and those people of their time. Wyndham Lewis. They were undermined by the likes of Alice Bailey and Helena Blavatsky. So it's been going on for centuries, really, this subversion of society. And talking about that, there was another argument in the book I really liked about having children, because my generation is the one, you know, I was young in the 80s, I was a childbearing age in the 80s, and we were the ones that it was very confusing, because we were being the propaganda was that we were overpopulating the planet, and I had three children and I felt really guilty that I had three children, you know. Little did I know what was, and you know, you had three children and you were told about all these starving kids everywhere. Literally, it was non-stop starving kids all over the world. You wanted to help them, and you know, so you didn't have any. Three was pushing you, having one too many, is according to the propaganda. But here it says in the book, under the society thing, who cares if we have fewer children? The earth is overpopulated anyway. And the rebuttal is only whites who are having fewer children, and it's only non-white countries that are overpopulated. Is Canada overpopulated? Is Australia overpopulated? Are the United States overpopulated? No, we're fine. And if you look at, if you took out the non-whites out of Europe, they'd be fine too. The other races are multiplying at an incredible rate, and nothing we can do will change that. The only thing we can change is will we be part of the future world? So, yeah, I like that. I wish I'd read that, you know, when I was 25.
Yeah, it's one of the things that breaks my heart most, that these hand rubbers, the same people that promote all this hedonism and liberalism, are the people that are making European people guilty for having children. And you know, they're saying we're overpopulated, yet they're opening our borders to all these people from around the world. And, you know, overpopulation doesn't matter then. It's one of the sickest thing these people have done to our people, that so many men and women are deciding they don't want to bring children into this world. It's actually horrific.
The worst thing is the politicians are busy talking out of both sides of their mouths. Because on one hand, they're berating the fact that there's not enough children being born in this country, or the population's too low, we need to bring in more immigrant workers and all the rest of it. Whilst on the other hand, promoting all their newspapers and everything else, telling white people to stop having babies and there's a climate emergency and all this other rubbish that's presumably, like you said, Sal, been going on for the last 30 years plus. You know, it's always, oh, we're going to be at a tipping point in 10 years, you know, where there's going to be another tipping point in 10 years. It's always just 10 years off. I think that Down syndrome girl from Scandinavia, what's her name? Thunberg, was at Glastonbury over the weekend, spouting off the same thing. We've only got 10 years. It's like, well, I seem to remember you saying something similar 10 years ago, you know, just this rubbish, this scolding of Europeans, wherever they are and wherever they've expanded to, whether it's South Africa, whether it's Australia, whether it's North America, into just genociding themselves. We know who's doing it. We know who's telling them to do these things, you know, but it's us who are being censored and shut down. All the while, the arguments against us that are seeding the ideas of self-destruction and negation and horror and complete disenfranchisement are just pumped out mainstream day by day by day, so that people like us have to argue with drones who have one word attacks to try and belittle us and make us sound crazy, when we're the furthest people from crazy. We're the stewards. We have the ideas, but the stewardship of the future of who we are. You know, it's not going to be up to someone from India or someone from Pakistan like Priti Patel or that other guy, the Chancellor, the 3'4" dwarven hobbit Chancellor of the Exchequer, to tell me in my country how the future is going to be, or what the future of my people and my country should be. no, that's completely wrong. It's wrong on an instinctive level. And to be able to articulate it is no small thing. And to bring it back to the book, that's what this book helps you to do.
Yeah, for me, nationalism is a positive message. It's something that I'm proud of. I believe it's the answer to pretty much all our problems. If you've got a sound worldview, ethno nationalism, you know, you've got an answer for everything. Put your people first in everything you do. You know, they ask us, you know, have you got a source for this, all the rest of it? You don't need a source for it. You do what's instinctively right for your people. And I think what PA does, and what this book also does in spades, is be brave and be open. Because if we take every opportunity we have to discuss these things with the people in our lives and show that we're not hiding some dirty little secret, it gives them confidence. I think it was yourself, Nat, who said it earlier. You know, this book can give other people the confidence to do these things. I've got a lady who works for us, and she originally used to live in the States, and she was actually a Bernie Sanders voter. And I thought, oh my goodness, what have we hired here? You know, she's going to be trouble. And she came in one day, and she was discussing some charity thing. She was trying to get a collection. And my question was, I says, where are these funds going? Are they going to support British charity? Because for me, charity begins from home. I only give to British charities. And she was taken back, and she said, oh, Kenny, that's you know, a really negative attitude, and you know there's poor people around the world. And I said to her, if you had only a small amount of money, enough to buy, you know, the bare essentials in a weekly shop, would you feed your family first, or would you feed the neighbor's kids? And you could actually physically see the penny drop in her head. And she goes, I'll feed my family first, but if I've got any left over, I'll help the rest. And I said, exactly. That's how I feel too. See, when everybody's taken care of in this country, I'll gladly help anybody next door and around the rest of the world. But while we've got people starving, old folk who can't turn on their heating, schools that can't tell you that they can't afford books, hospitals that can't provide medication for people, I'm not giving one penny to anybody outside of this country. And she basically the rest of the day, she didn't stop talking about this, how she really actually understood that what charity begins at home actually meant. She thought that was being selfishness and people just, you know, looking after themselves, ignoring others. But no, it's looking after your own people, your own family. And these are the interactions that we need to have with other people to make them understand what nationalism is. There's no point all of us having this understanding, going on to, you know, platforms like Telegram and just chatting amongst ourselves. We have to get out into the real world and put the lessons this book teaches us into action in the real world.
Yeah, totally agree. One of the things I mentioned briefly in my intro was how Roe versus Wade being repealed has got even people who I know. I mean, I'm on Instagram and I've got friends on there, some of whom are girls and women, who are posting stuff about the repealing of Roe versus Wade. And it's like they don't know what they're talking about. And I've had an argument with one or two of them along the lines of this book, you know, the kind of responses that I know to give. But it's like, it's a real surface level understanding of the issue. There's nothing else there. It's just repeating something for social points or social acceptance points, especially if it's something posting on Instagram or posting on Facebook or whatever it is, you know, because they feel safe saying it. Whereas the things we're saying, people don't feel safe saying it because the whole of society has been taught not to. So the book is trying to break that conditioning and saying, no, we're right. You know, we're right to say this, and it's acceptable to say these things, and you may not feel safe, but it's an illusion to not feel that way or not feel that you can say the things you feel or the truths that are self-evident, you know.
I agree with that fundamentally. Now, we are an hour and 15 minutes into the show, so we have got some super chats. We've got three super chats and a couple of questions, so we're going to do those. If you haven't super chatted yet and you want to super chat, you can do so either through Odyssey or through Entropy. But let's do some of these, and we'll do them all, and we'll answer them as best we can. So Archie gave $5, thank you so much, and said, Lawrence Summers backed Fink's claims that nationalism leads to protectionism and anti-immigration, thus causing inflation in the USA because there are not enough people to fill empty jobs. Fink says USA needs 2 million people per year. We know that the solution is marrying early. Well, thank you very much. And yeah, I think that's... I think the argument about mass immigration sort of aiding us economically is based on the fact that we have an aging population. And one of the things that always gets me with the argument of an aging population is that we have been told repeatedly not to have children. We've been told that having children is terrible for us. It's terrible for the environment. It is terrible for our country as a whole, that we are happier if we don't do these things. And we've been guilt tripped in many ways into not having children. Then when we don't have children, we're told, oh, you fools, you didn't have children. You're going to have to import lots of young, virile, non-white men of fighting age who are going to come and do all the jobs. And where has that led us? So thank you for that super chat. Archie gave another $3. Thank you so much. He said, Yuval Harari talks about the necessity of nationalism to solve big problems. He emphasizes that nations aren't tribes. He defines a tribe as a group upwards of 200 people that know each other. Okay, thank you very much.
Mark, can I just make a comment on the first super chat?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, if anyone's got anything to comment on these, go for it.
So I'm not sure if you've seen it. The clip the super chat was talking about is Larry Fink of BlackRock talking about why there's inflation in the US, and you know, you could expand it out to include the UK as well, basically blaming nationalism. All that is, we know who Larry Fink is, we know what race he belongs to, we know what ethnicity he is. It's just him blaming his enemies. He's doing a version of what's in this book, where he's attacking, you know, he's in a position of dominance in a meta sense because he's got the platform to do that, to sit in this chair with this interviewer on mainstream television and attack who he perceives as his enemies. In that case, white North Americans, you know, European Americans, who would absolutely oust him if they knew what he was about, knew who he was and had the political power to do so. So Larry Fink is just doing what we would be doing in his position, right? Blaming the other side. It's the same as when there's any political issue comes up in this country, the Conservatives will blame the Labour Party, the Labour Party will blame the Conservatives, you know, endlessly. It's just that. So understand who Larry Fink is, understand where he's coming from, and understand why we need to depose people like him.
Thank you. And we have a final super chat from Archie for $3. Thank you so much. So the nation is a larger group that finds ways to unite strangers using common stories. What is he avoiding? Well, I think the idea that bringing people together through some kind of common ideas is really something that's come about very recently. So only very recently have I heard this, and it's something that seems to be pushed by both liberals and actually by conservatives. It's a line that's held by both sides of the sort of false political spectrum, which tries to lock us out of any form of discourse. And they both say that Britain is an idea, America is just an idea, every nation is just an idea that anybody can come to and fit in with as long as they subscribe to the idea. I think that's completely false. I'm sorry if I've misread that one as well. I'm not sure about this speech that you're talking about, but I hope I've got that right. Kelt asked a question for Kenny and said, Kenny, you live in a remote white Scotland. Was it a book that caused you to become active in nationalism so long ago, or something else?
Great question. I did live in probably one of the whitest places in the whole of the UK. I'm originally from the Isle of Lewis in the Western Isles, the most northwesterly island in the country. And we did have a small Pakistani community who were the people that came over with, you know, they were the very Uriah Heep kind of people, very humble, nice and polite. But they would come over like with a suitcase full of clothes and then go around the houses selling it, buying stuff, and then built up. And eventually some of these people actually had stores in Stornoway. And one of them even spoke Gaelic, which was phenomenal when considering this. A lot of people from Stornoway themselves don't speak Gaelic. But it wasn't really that. I basically was one of these kids who always supported the underdog. I was a bit rebellious, and you know, I support Partick Thistle instead of everybody else's Rangers or Celtic, or you know, Aberdeen and Dundee United were popular back then because they were successful. But I was always kind of a bit rebellious, and I got into the punk movement, which took me into you know, the rock against communism scene, the skinheads and stuff like that. And it was actually listening to a bootleg tape of Ian Stuart Donaldson, and the words that he said in between the songs that really hit home for me, and that I felt. So I then wrote away to a fanzine that was advertising national stuff and the stuff that Ian was talking about. And I got National Front papers, I got British National Party papers, went along to my first BNP meetings a little later, and got properly educated by the people I met. But before I actually moved to the mainland, I relied mostly on things like National Alliance publications. There was the Oak from the UK, National Vanguard. I read John Tyndall's Spearhead. I had a massive collection of these things. I used to get every publication going. Basically, I bought lots of books from an early age around there to expand my worldview. I very quickly learned not to be a fascist because Mosley didn't deal with the JQ. I read a lot of books on socialism, a lot of books on nationalism. And so I don't think there's one book did it. It was mainly the words of one man initially that spoke to me. And then I learned and I read and I became educated. But the best lesson that I ever got was from guys like Scott McLean, Jim Laird, Stevie Cartwright, you know, the BNP officers in Scotland when I first joined were really sensible, screwed on people who told me, you know, don't be a skinhead, get serious and you know, be of service to your people rather than just being a follower.
Okay, thank you very much. A very comprehensive answer. Saturn5 gave £3. Thank you so much. And says, does the panel think that the fundamental change in our favour would be as a result of one major upheaval, a hard smack on the nose, or emerge from several factors? Well, I'll answer this first. I think this is a really good question. What would it take to wake people up? What would it take to get things changing? I think there would need to be a series of converging catastrophes, if you like. I think you'd have to have several things all come together at the same time to make a massive change. So you would need economic, social, and sort of large national issues all coming together at the same time to bring about change. But saying all that, my outlook is one that this is a fight for the long haul, and I don't think there's any immediate answers, and I don't think there's going to be a big immediate upheaval that will work in our favour, because people are becoming less and less willing to actually stand up and make a difference. And I'll give you an example of that. It wasn't long ago that people were protesting, blockading roads over petrol hitting £1 a litre. Now petrol's hitting £2 a litre. Nobody's doing anything. And one thing that always bothers me to a certain degree is that people on the continent seem very willing to do something. They have this revolutionary spirit. It's almost built into them. So the French, for example, are very willing, even now, years after numerous revolutions, to go out on the street as either the Yellow Vests or to vote for an alternative form of governance. The best we ever got was UKIP, which failed to make any meaningful breakthroughs at a parliamentary level. And they were so soft, I think if they had got in, they would have been completely ineffective and fallen to pieces as a parliamentary group. So I think they'd take quite a bit in this country, and it would be a convergence of numerous great crises all at the same time. What do you think, Kenny? Then we'll go Laura and Sally and Natty.
Sorry, Mark, I wasn't really paying attention. I have to say.
The guy, Saturn 5, asked, he said, does the panel think that fundamental change in our favour would be a result of one major upheaval or a number of smaller, several factors all intertwining?
Yeah, I don't think there's no going to be any quick fix for this. We're in for a long, long struggle. There's no two ways about it. And for me, that's why we have to build community. I believe we have to manage the expectations of people in the movement. If you read the history of the movement, going back, you know, to even to the BUF days and before, they would have massive peaks and troughs of people. The NF had the same. The BNP had the same. You know, something would happen in the public eye, would drive people to us. And these people thought they were in for an instant win. You know, they just have to stick in for a year and it's going to happen. Rubbish. You have to work for it and win your people over. For me, as long as people have jobs, as long as they have their distractions, you know, their TV, their internet, the majority of the people aren't going to wake up. And so that means that we have to become positive influences within the community to make that happen. Otherwise, I think people, you know, it's like the boiling frog analogy, isn't it? You know, as long as it's the heat isn't turned up too far, these people will just sit in and get boiled to death. You know, there's no quick fix, people, and it's going to be a long, painful thing. And we've seen in the past with the BNP, the thing that made the difference for communities was we would get activists actually going into communities and making a physical difference in these people's lives and a positive impact in these lives. There's a great story I tell a lot of time from Burnley that sadly isn't in Steve Smith's book, but they went to a housing estate once and put a whole pile of skips in and put, you know, magnetic BNP posters on saying these skips are free for the community. Let's clean up this estate. You know, they went around and leafleted the place. The community absolutely loved it. People filled these things up. I think they had to do it a second time, if I remember correctly. It was so popular. And the enemy absolutely panicked. They sent Labour MPs across. You tell them, oh, don't vote for the BNP. They're Nazis. And basically the community rose up and told them, bugger off, get out of our estate. The BNP are the first people who have ever done anything positive for our lives. And it seems simple. You know, all they've done is just clean up a dirty park or a dirty estate. But that actually made something good happen for these people. They could take their kids to the park and there was no rubbish, there was no needles, there was no dog poo. They made a positive impact in these people's lives. And when the enemy comes and starts saying, don't trust people who's Nazi, they're saying, we don't care what you call them. They actually helped us. That for me is where it's going to count for us, that we actually become leaders in our own communities and dispel myths. Because like I said, for me, nationalism is a positive thing. It's the answer to all our problems. And we just have to be brave enough to get out there and spread the gospel.
Laura?
Sorry,
it's all right. If you want to defer this to the other people, do you want to move on?
Is there, I can answer. Sam's gone to a gig when I have a stream again. But I don't think these big events do wake up the majority of people, because if we look at things like the Black Lives Matter riots, like a year and a half ago, nearly 2 years ago, if you didn't wake up during that, then what is going on? Do you know what I mean? I think these big events do happen and people trickle over to us. And I do think we grow daily. But I think the majority of people will just take whatever's the most comfortable option. And if we were in power and we had the media on our side, then most people would be openly and confidently nationalists. So I think it's up to a very sort of dedicated and strong-willed few to lead by example. And then I think eventually most people will come over to our worldview. But I don't think there's going to be some massive event where everyone's like, okay, I'm a nationalist now. I don't think it happens like that. I think it's, like Kenny said, it's a slow battle. And we see people join Patriotic Alternative, and then because we haven't secured total victory within 6 months, they're like, oh, I can't do it, and they drop out. But there was plenty of us that were there on that first day, and we know that this is not going to be solved in 5 years or even 10 years, and it's a really long struggle. That's why we call it a struggle, isn't it? And I think we need people that have got that longevity, really, to stick it out. So, yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Okay, Sally and Natty, what do you think?
I agree with what everybody else has said. The subversion's been going on for a very, very long time, and it's going to take a long time to undo. I think the elderly, or the boomers, seem to be the worst to try and bring over to our side. They just don't want to know. There's a few of us, but not in enough numbers, I don't think. But so I think it's the target audience. Maybe, you know, it's the young, the Zoomers and the millennials. We need to educate more. And it's hard because they've grown up in the system. They've been educated against their own best interests. So I think it's more education. And I know we can't go into schools and do anything, but education in real life. You know, where we just keep telling other parents, like, you know, showing them what the agenda that's in the school books and that's in the media on the films and stuff. And the more they see that, the more they'll see what's really going on. I think that's what I think anyway.
Well, my answer to this is probably slightly black-pilling, maybe a bit depressive, but after reading Solzhenitsyn's book, The Gulag Archipelago, it's apparent, like Kenny says, with the boiling of the frog, just how compressed you can make people before they do anything. And even then, you know, you get to the point where you put them in a camp and they die from logging duties after 3 weeks, starvation rations. Just how a crumb of comfort can turn people inwards and stop them mobilizing. You know, in the camps, in the gulags, a simple comfort like a piece of bread or an extra shirt to keep you warm at night was enough to stop people uniting because they didn't have anything else. So it's like, well, this is mine now. This is mine. I have to protect myself from my fellow inmates, the other people who are in here with me. You know, I've got to look out for myself. Now, on that note, however, I will say that I was convinced by Gavin Bobey. I don't know if you guys remember him. He turned up and he spoke to Chris Dangerfield a year ago, maybe a little bit more than a year ago, and he talked about how things would go downhill quite fast. And he was convinced it was the collapse of the welfare state. You know, if the government runs out of money or if the government is unable to provide services in the way that they currently do, so electricity, internet, water, you would rapidly see people just tribe up, basically, and it would be very messy. And I think this is his thesis: it would be very messy, and over the course of a few years, it would gradually sort itself out. And people who are actually responsible and actually had a thought for the future, rather than the kind of 5-year election cycle, would come to the fore. By its very nature, they would be nationalistic because they would have spent time looking after the people around them and gaining enough of a power base to then kind of expand that out. So it's kind of pie in the sky stuff, but I was fairly convinced by that argument. Yeah.
Okay. And we have a super chat from a coconut nut, a big nut, who gave $3 and said, "Dear Mark, what was your wake up moment? You're the greatest." Well, I have to concur with the last part of your super chat. That is a very astute observation on your behalf. My wake up call was just living where I lived. I lived in a small village, all white, called Rothley, community, everyone dead friendly.
biggest major city nearby, Leicester, very multicultural. Compared the two from a young age, from going shopping with my mother in the village to the butchers, the bakers, the greengrocers, the newspaper shop, then going with my mum to Leicester. Wow. Well, you saw the difference. And the difference wasn't just the level of community. It was the difference in people. And the more diverse you went, the less community there was and the less you felt at home. And that's something that lived with me through my whole life. And I just was instinctively drawn to nationalism after being brought up with those two very big differences in my life. So thank you for the super chat. Max Anderson gave £10. Thank you so much. And he said, Countercurrents had a good podcast recently. They said nationalist organizations could be more like the NRA with a legislative arm attacking policy and running ads against candidates they don't like. Well, I've got to say this. I think one of the big things that's come about very recently, and it's not actually PA related, I'll give credit where credit's due. One of the big breakthroughs lately within the nationalist community is the Workers of England Union. Now, I know this doesn't help our friends north of the border like Kenny, but the Workers of England Union has been one of the most powerful advocacy groups for people of European descent living in Britain. People who have been discriminated against with the face masks, with the forced jabs, etc. And I think one of the most powerful things that we've developed is this legal response. PA have obviously helped people with legal responses in other ways, but the Workers of England Union have been great. And I think the NRA is a good organization to base what we do on, because fundamentally, they do apply major pressure. Now, I don't think our MPs or our councillors would listen, but we can apply legal pressure and advocacy to big organisations. And I think that we've promoted Workers of England Union. We've obviously had Robin Tilbrook help us with advice for how to deal with the police and prevent, etc. And I think that legal string to our bow as nationalists is something that's very, very important. And I will say this, that groups like the NRA, groups in America that are advocacy groups, do push on the legal front. And that's something that nationalists haven't done enough of in the past. So I think that's been a big change. Embrace the Struggle said, hopefully Mark reads the chapter on homosexuality and reconsiders his stance on dissident right individuals who happen to be homosexuals. I would say that there are people within the dissident right who are ultimately providing a good service to nationalism. Now, the way I judge homosexuals is that I think the homosexual lifestyle is rather degenerate, it's rather deviant. We're seeing this with the monkeypox. Their lifestyle is not conducive to being healthy. It's not conducive to a long life. It's also not conducive to family values, etc. However, not everybody who is a homosexual leads what we would call the homosexual lifestyle. There are homosexuals who do not lead a degenerate life, who do still think that family values are important and who do push for the rights of people of European descent. Now, if there was a homosexual that wanted to be involved with PA and I didn't know they were homosexual and they kept it behind closed doors and they didn't push for it in any way, I would fundamentally not even know they were homosexual. So how would I have an issue with that? Now, if there was a homosexual who wanted to join PA and wanted to hand out PA leaflets at gay pride events and wanted to come to PA conferences dressed up as one of the village people, that would be something completely different. So I think we have to judge people on their actions. And what I'll also say is people often like to criticize one particular nationalist author and activist and speaker about his homosexuality. And this guy has done an awful lot for this cause. He's done an incredible amount for this cause. And one thing I will say is, if you're going to throw stones at that guy, make sure you've done something for this cause which is in some way comparable. Because one thing that always strikes me as odd is when people in this movement, and I say movement in inverted commas, are taken very seriously, and they're faceless, nameless, they hide behind an avatar online, but have all manner of constructive, in inverted commas, criticism for those in the movement who actually show their faces, put their necks on the line, and do a lot of work. If you want to have your criticisms and inputs taken seriously, you have to, in some way, prove that you are someone who should be taken seriously. If you want to be taken seriously, you have to prove that. And that means you have to put something into the movement. And I do not believe that democracy is the best system. I believe a system of meritocracy is a good system. And meritocracy is a system whereby people who commit to a cause, put something in and work hard, have more input in the steering of that cause. So I've got to say, ultimately, when it comes down to it, if you're going to criticize the guy that you criticized in the super chat, make sure you're doing something comparable to his level of input, because, you know, he does an awful lot.
I was just going to say, well said, Mark. There's a lot of people who are fond of throwing stones in this wider movement who do absolutely nothing at all, but they aim their slings and arrows at people who do work. And I'm sure that there are probably more homosexuals in the wider movement than people think. I know there were some in the BNP who even stood as candidates, and nobody was aware they were homosexual because they didn't behave in a camp manner. They were very discreet about it. You know, they were not people who tried to force homosexuality down the throats of other people. They just were aware that that's what they were. And I dare say some of them were probably ashamed of it, but they kept it to themselves, you know, to a degree behind closed doors. They weren't promoting it. They agreed with the BNP stance and family values. And I bet that there's probably people still in the movement today exactly in the same boat. And if they're doing good work for the movement, you know, I'm not going to throw any stones at them.
Well said. I think the other thing is that it's just in general, sexuality as a political position is the kind of underlying issue here, right? It's because you wouldn't want someone who was a leader or a thought leader to be out there promoting any sort of sexuality as some sort of raison d'etre, a reason for being, a reason for pushing political issues, you know? And just to add to what you were saying, Mark, as to the people who criticize you for your stance on certain things, you've got to remember, most of the time, like you said, these people are anonymous. They've got, you know, whatever picture is their avatar on Telegram or in a YouTube comment. You don't know who you're arguing with. I mean, you could be, you can kind of guess sometimes by the kind of things they say, you could be arguing, for all you know, with someone who looks like Harvey Price and is probably a few brain cells short of someone like Harvey Price. It's not.
I'm wondering where this is going.
You imagine, you know, that you're speaking with someone who, maybe you imagine that they're some sort of professorial type who's got their head around all these issues and knows about all this stuff. But in actual fact, a lot of the time it's attention seeking. It's just nagging and trying to push buttons and stuff like that. So, just ignoring people who are naysayers or don't have anything constructive to add is a perfectly legitimate way to go about things, I think.
I've also got to say as well, if we were living in the perfect world, then we could legislate for us all to be absolutely perfect, and that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? But I've got to say this. At the moment, we are so close to annihilation. Turning down talented, decent people who are pushing in the right direction is madness. It would be akin to being on the Titanic and a load of lifeboats turn up, and then you say, no, turn those lifeboats away. They're not the regulation lifeboat shade of red. You know, they need to be a couple of shades lighter. Take them away, get them repainted and bring them back. Well, when you're in a crisis, you take what you get and you work with it and you attempt to build a movement from what you've got. And that's not me being a defeatist. That's me being a pragmatist. Because if we are looking for utter perfection, if we're looking for a group where everyone agrees with each other on 100% of the issues 100% of the time, we will all be in a party of one. And it's as simple as that. And we've got another question here from Kelt. He says, everybody, this book is for riposts. What is your favorite first strike argument to win an audience over to nationalism? Your favorite first strike argument? Well, mine just has to be that we are the indigenous people of these islands. And as such, we have a birthright to them. And like any other indigenous people, we should not be reduced to a minority in our ancestral homeland. And I think that chimes very well with most people. What do you all say when you introduce yourself as a nationalist and you lay down your first strike argument, as he said? What is that? We'll start with you, Kenny, and we'll go around the group.
Yeah, pretty much what you just said. We are the indigenous people of these islands, and we have a right to be proud of our history and our heritage and to govern ourselves. That's it. It's about self-determination for our own people. And I'm not going to be ashamed of saying that publicly.
Laura, do you have a take, or have you got the... you have, because Sam's away at his gig. Blimmin' hell, why do you let him get away with this?
I says to him, why have you booked a gig when you know I've got book club? And he's like, I bought these tickets before me and you got together. So we bought these tickets years ago, apparently, and it's all...
Who's
been
his
cancelled. Rammstein.
Oh.
It's all been... I think it's been cancelled and delayed and stuff because of COVID, but yeah. She's all right. She's just...
Give him a slap anyway.
But yeah, one thing that I always do when I'm having discussions with people is I always try and twist it round to another group. So if somebody says something like, why would you be proud of something that you had no control over, you know, talking about our people, then I'd say, would you say that to Black Lives Matter supporters, or would you say that to somebody at a gay pride march? Or if they say something like, British, what do you mean? Is it the Angles or the Saxons or the Jews? I'd say, well, you know, would you say to a Japanese person, what is Japanese? And then break their ethnic group down. And usually when you flip it round to a non-white group, it really does highlight like how anti-white they really are. And I think if you can do that, hopefully they might go away and think about it. But if they don't, at least the people who were watching saw how things are different for us, and maybe that will encourage them to take their own side as well.
Yeah, I love what Laura just said, and I wish I could remember it when it comes up. But I do sort of tend to say what Mark and Kenny said about it's the indigenous people. It's about us. It's our homeland. People are different races because they belong in different environments, different heats. That's why they, you know, people from Africa are black because of the sun. You know, we belong here. This is our country. We absorb vitamin D differently to other races, and they belong. They belong there in their own continent. So, that's where I stand. That's what I say to other boomers anyway.
I mean, the best thing to do is just ask a question. You know, if someone says, well, that's a bit racist, you say, what do you mean racist? And they'll just fall apart straight away. You know, what their idea of racism is like a precursor is just some anti-white claptrap that they've heard. And they can't just say, oh, it's discrimination based on race, because then you can, that opens them up to all sorts of stuff. So the first thing you can do, if you're ever on the back foot, if you're ever wondering how to respond to someone who's coming at you of something, just ask them the question. I'll just turn it straight around on them. You're racist. What do you mean racist? Well, that's pretty bigoted of you. You're a homophobe. You're a homophobe. You're a transphobe. What do you mean? What do you mean transphobe? Explain that. And watch how quickly they crumble. That's the first strike. It's the best tactic. It gives you breathing room, and it makes them have to think about what they're saying, which most of the time they can't do. Like I said, it's surface. They have a surface level understanding of all of these issues to a much lesser degree than you do. So if you ask them a question, they'll crumble.
Yeah, I'd just like to add something to that, actually. Usually people say stuff and it's like, it is just empty words that mean nothing. And if you actually ask them to explain, I'll give you an example, they can't do. And I posted on my Telegram channel the other day, Gary Lineker was saying, refugees bring skills and talents. If you said to him, what skills and talents do they bring that we can't do ourselves? I guarantee you he would not be able to say one thing. But they use all these buzzwords and fancy words and, like, you know, nice little things wrapped up in bows. But if you actually ask them to explain something and say, oh, can you give me an example of that? 9 times out of 10, they haven't got a clue. They just know what they're supposed to say, but they can't actually go in, you know, scratch below the surface or go into any more depth. So yeah, I completely agree with Natty.
And just to add to it, people like Gary Lineker and his ilk have been given immense kind of space by the fact that nobody is allowed to rebut them. No one who could rebut them or has the sense or will or willingness to rebut them has any form of presence online in which to do so. You know, Gary Lineker can post something like that that gets hundreds of thousands of retweets and likes by, quite frankly, morons. And the people who would slap him down, who deserve to slap him down, are silenced all across the place. So these people's grip on the kind of national discourse or international discourse in some cases is completely astroturfed. It's not real. It's a manifestation of those who hold power over us at the moment. So that's, I guess I'm just explaining really why it is that they're allowed to say such stupid things and how easy it would be to take them down if we were allowed to or given the space to rebut them.
Yeah, I do agree with that. You've got these people whose ideas are presented in such a vacuum, and when ideas are presented in a vacuum, they're much easier to uphold, unless they're, you know, them being presented in a you know, an open environment. Archie gave $5. Thank you so much. And the Japanese courts recently said that not allowing gay marriage is not constitutional, but they are LGBT groups pushing for gay marriage, arguing that there are social and economic advantages. Global corporations don't like nations that aren't LGBT friendly. Well, indeed. But I do think it's good that Japan is basically standing up against the LGBT lobby. I think that's really important. It's nice to know there is a developed world nation doing that. I know there are other countries that do, but for Japan to do, I think that's a pretty big thing. So we're getting towards the end of the show, and we've answered all of the questions. So if anyone else has got any super chats or questions, get them in now, because we are about to round up. And we will now give our final thoughts on the book. And we'll go around the group. We will start. We'll give the final word to Kenny, obviously. He'll tell you where you can get the book. But let's give Laura, Aunt Sally, Natty, then myself. And let's have a good roundup. All right?
Yes. Well, I do recommend the book. Like I say, I bought it myself to support Claymore Books. And it's a good one. It's you know, sometimes you get books from book club and it's like, oh, I probably won't read that again. But I think this is one that I will come back to. So I do recommend it, and also recommend that you support Claymore Books. And perhaps when Kenny speaks, he can tell us what the next book's going to be, because it's an exciting one. But yeah, this book is good for when you're debating 99% of people that you debate, because they do not debate in good faith. I wouldn't recommend it if you're having a conversation with, like, I don't know, like maybe if I was talking to my dad or my brother and they wanted to understand something a little bit more, we'd have a more in-depth conversation and go over things in more depth. I wouldn't use this book for that, but I would use it for like 99% of conversations when people are just trying to catch you out or humiliate you. This will just stop them in their tracks and put you into the position of power. So yeah, I do recommend it. And I just wanted to say thanks for having me as well. And I'll be back tomorrow with Sam for tea time. And I pass it to Aunt Sally.
Yeah, I think it's a really good book as well. I really, really enjoyed reading it, and I will read it again and again, and I probably will leave it in the toilet, you know, because that's where the brightest light in the house is, to be honest. I think it's a really good start, the book, for someone like me who I just get lost. I get slapped down in any debate. I don't actually want to debate anybody, but sometimes it crops up at family dinners and gatherings, and yeah, you know, I tend to avoid them, but I've now got a few sound bites to throw at people, so I'm really grateful to it for that. So yeah, I do recommend it. I really think every nationalist should have one. You really should. It's a really good book. And thank you for the microphone, and I hope my sound's been good tonight. Thank you, Mark.
It's been so good, Sally, that next episode of Book Club, you are doing it all on your own.
Oh, yeah. Good luck with that.
Natty, what are your final thoughts, my friend?
Even if this book was total trash and I didn't enjoy it and it didn't have any value, I would recommend it just because Claymore Books is a worthy cause. And this is the first publication from Claymore Books. You should be supporting them. If you're a British nationalist in any way, shape or form, you should buy a copy of this book. However, it is not a crap book. It is totally worthy, a totally worthy book to have on your bookshelf if you're even partially on the right, or even if you're not fully over, or you know, you're kind of wavering, whatever. This book is a fantastic edition. And I know that books, a lot of these books can be compared to Funko Pops, the way that Soy Boys and Manlets collect Funko Pops, right wingers collect books. But this is definitely one for the collection. So 100% recommend, go to Claymore Books, pick up a copy of this book, and you won't regret it.
Thank you. Well, my opinion on this book, I think I've made it quite clear. I think it answers the question I get asked all the time, or have been asked. We've been doing, I think it's about 263, 264 episodes of my weekly show now. So that's obviously over, that's about 5 years of doing a weekly show every week. It's a lot of shows. And throughout that 5 years, I've often been asked, how do I argue with people? How do I present arguments to my family, to my friends, to my co-workers? How would you answer this question? Well, you've now got a handy handbook, which gives you all of those answers. So buy it. It's not an expensive book, but it's worth every penny. In fact, I'd say this is worth its weight in gold if you were to want a book that helps you debate. And these sort of arguments do come up on a regular basis. And I've seen nationalists go into debates online, in person, and get completely minced by people who put forward emotional arguments, and they're just trying to argue in a dry way. And this book arms you with everything to fight back against those arguments and to completely dominate your opponent with wit, with short, snappy answers, with analogies that will hit home. It's worth the money, and it really does do something that I don't feel any other book that we've reviewed really does, which is actually arm our activists with the most important weapon of all, which is the weapon of being able to win the public discourse whenever you engage in debate. So yeah, and again, as Natty said, Claymore Books, another nationalist business that does deserve your support. So Kenny, you are the guy behind Claymore Books. So would you like to have the final word, my friend?
Thank you very much, Mark. And thank you to yourself and Laura. And lovely to speak with Sally and Natty. It's been a wee while. And I'm so glad that you all enjoyed the book so much. For me, we did this in the PA Scotland Book Club, which is an educational book club. We've got a set curriculum, and we do things for a reason. But we laughed so much doing this book. We broke it up into its different sections, and we made somebody do the arguments and somebody do the rebuttals. And we have some funny characters in Scotland who are brilliant at accents. So I'm sure you can imagine how some of the arguments went. But, you know, we absolutely laughed so much because this book is absolutely brutal against the enemy. Gordon Freeman, who's one of our officers in Scotland, a prolific writer for the website, you know, I was asking the guys in our book club, you know, how they found the book. And he was saying that for him, it helped him see and understand the patterns that the enemy have, and they certainly do, and it allowed him to be ready to crush him. And he's absolutely spot on. If you know your enemy, you'll defeat your enemy. And this book will do that for you. But you have to practice it. You know, don't just read it and forget it. There's loads of nationalist books I've only ever read once, and then it sits on my bookshelf, and you know, I sit and say I've got it, but I don't go back to it. But there's other books I will read religiously year after year, and I get different things from them as I age, as my life, with through my life experience. And this book, I think, is one of these things. You can dip in and out it, but you must read it, you know, regularly for me, and then tailor it to your own needs. And like Laura said, you know, it's not one for the family. Be nice to your family and friends. Don't try and belittle them and mock them. You want to win them over. But this is really, I'm so proud that this is our first book, because it is a useful tool of the national movement. I think there are so many books out there for nationalists, and they're basically telling you the history, or they're having a deep dive into some esoteric philosophical point. This book is practical help that can help us win the struggle. So, yeah, just want, you know, to finish off saying thank you very much to everybody for the amazing words in the book. And it was an absolute joy to be on the show. And thanks to everybody who was interacting in the Odyssey chat as well.
Wait, before okay. we end, Mark, before yeah, we, sure. we give your final thoughts. If you want to be able to mash rhetorically four Hebrews in a debate and make two of them storm off in rage, this is the book you start with. I'm sure you remember the debate Mark Collett had in 2017, 2018. This book would go some way into helping you be able to achieve such a thing.
Thank you for those kind words. And yeah, that was a good night. That was a good night. I think tonight's been a good night as well. I always enjoy our chats with this little group. And we will be back next month. Next month, though, we have a very different book. We have a science fiction book set in the future. It's a nationalist book, but a science fiction novel. It's one that Natty really is looking forward to, and one that Laura is dreading. So we'll see how that one works out. I'm looking forward to it as well. And thank you for tuning in tonight. Thank you to Kenny. Thank you to Laura. Thank you to Anne Sally. Thank you to Natty. Thank you to all those who donated so generously. Thank you to everyone who tuned in. This community is absolutely wonderful. Laura and Sam will be back tomorrow night for tea time, and I'll be back on Wednesday with Morgoth for PWR. It's going to be a good one. Until then, stay strong, keep fighting, pick up this book, and I'll see you all again soon. Thank you and good night, everyone.